Today I'm speaking with Craig Burgess at EBI, and it's a long overdue conversation because it really strikes at the heart of what we do when it comes to investing for clients. So good afternoon, Craig.
Good afternoon, Duncan.
And I wanted to kick off, Craig, with a question about when clients, either existing clients or new clients, come to us and they want to know how we invest their money. And simply, we say to them, well, really, we've got two options here. We can either do this internally, and this would involve obviously having experts in-house, admin, everything else. And obviously, that would come at quite sizable cost and questionable whether we would get the right expertise. Or we can outsource this whole process to another organization. And I think critically for us, with whom we've got the sort of required shared beliefs and values, can you, for the benefit of any investor, outline the role that you actually perform as what we call our outsourced investment partner?
A little bit of background, I think, in terms of the way we all invest money nowadays, those of us that have gone down the evidence-based route. I mean, evidence-based means you read the literature that's been pumped out for 50, 60 years by academics, and you come to a conclusion that these are the disciplines that we should have in building a portfolio for clients. And we all read the same documentation from the same Nobel Prize winning academics and professors of finance galore around the world. And a bit like any form of evidence, all roads pretty much lead to Rome. We all built very, very similar portfolios. And this is a very different approach to when we have advisors who think they can see around corners and can pick the next Microsoft. There are any number of ways in which you can think that you're able to do this. And so, you know, they sit in-house and they look at all kinds of stuff. They go and buy their Bloomberg terminal. They pay for external information to help them with decisions. But when you come to evidence-based, we all build very, very similar portfolios. And so when we meet advisors and we look at what they've already done in this space, it's usually an extremely similar set of portfolios to the ones that we've built. So all that really EBI is, it's the sum total of, currently about 90 to 100 advisors putting together their minds and building portfolios and realizing that doing the same thing 90 times over is very suboptimal. And it'd be better if somebody picked up the challenge and said, well, why don't I do it for all the rest of you? And kind of literally this is how it all started. I was actually press ganged into doing this by three advisors who said, look, you know, I've got better things to do in my time than build the same portfolios as these three other guys. And we realize, I think advisors realize that they weren't actually able to build a better portfolio. I've never met one in this space that said, well, actually, you know what, I think an extra 0.25% in emerging markets is actually the killer deal, and that's going to make all the difference. So what we're doing at a very high level is building the portfolios that advisors will probably build themselves if only they have the time to do it, and provide all the resources that are around these portfolios to help them get the information across to clients and provide the right literature, et cetera, and conversations like this, hopefully, that maybe have some value. And so I think that's kind of at a high level what we do for advisors. We're not doing anything. We will take no credit for a good year. It's simply we employ the evidence that the other advisors have read the same as we have.
You touched briefly there, Craig, on one of the obvious reasons why we chose to do this for clients, such that really we were just duplicating time and unlikely to replicate the expertise that you and your resources are putting into it. But from an investor point of view, can you give any other sort of reasons why they really benefit from this? As I say, the obvious one is that we then spend far more time thinking strategically, planning for them, etc. But can you give them two or three other benefits for the investors as opposed to the benefits for me as an advisor?
Yeah, there are multiple. I could go down to a lot longer list than three, but I mean, a few things that maybe that they're not aware of. None of the advisors we work with by themselves would have enough buying power to really influence suppliers. That would be platforms for custody or software providers or actual fund managers themselves. But when you put it all together, and we have roughly about $1 billion of assets. That actually makes us one of the largest clients of Vanguard in this country. Bear in mind, we were dealing with Vanguard before they arrived in the UK in the 2004. We liked their story so much that we had them come and see us, I think, 2002, 2003. So they regard us as a long-term business partner. And so with our Vantage service, we have access to Institutional Plus. Now, Institutional Plus is a discounted share class that you have to have 200 million per fund before they allow you to have it. So every single client on all the platforms that we work with can only get access to Vantage, to Vanguard Institutional Plus if they use our portfolios. So if you're a Transact client or a Wealthtime or a Nucleus client, these are your very popular platforms for custody. The only way that you can get access to the Vanguard's lower cost products is through us. So you know, we've got buying power that's come by all of us pooling together and allowing us to be the voice on behalf of all of these advisors. And you know, $1 billion is a lot of money, but it's in the scheme of things, it still makes us a reasonably small fund manager. So our best days are ahead of us, probably. But these very same fund managers also, we have quite a lot of influence over them in terms of product. If we say, for instance, that I mean, a good example is iShares. We wanted a particular share class that they didn't have. So their global property fund back in 2011 only had share classes that paid commission. Now via Transact, that would have been rebated, or via most platforms, pretty much all platforms, that money would be rebated. But we didn't want to lose that money and have it back a 2 or 3 months later. We wanted a clean share class. So they launched that for us in October 2012. And whenever Vanguard are thinking about what funds they want to launch, they come and see us and we'll say, well, we think that this would be a good fund to have. We also get the heads up on funds. So if they're launching a fund in the near future, they'll give us the heads up so we can start talking to advisors and maybe get access to that from day one when there may be a discount. That's happened in the past with some of their bond funds that used to have an initial charge but was waived in the first few months. So these are so that we can help drive down the costs, and your costs are really, really important in investing. And a pound saved is real. Whereas a pound of potential performance, well, it may or may not arrive. So we're trying to eradicate costs at all points. And advisors just plain don't get the scale to be able to have any real influence. But you know, Vanguard don't want to lose a few hundred million from a fund from us. So they're more likely to sharpen their pencil to try and keep the business on behalf of all our underlying clients. So this all goes on in the background. I mean, that's just one out of any number of ones, but it's probably the most important. I guess another one which might be quite useful mentioning is, with all due respect to you, Duncan, and all other advisors, you kind of got better things to do all day long than stare at prices and funds. Now, we don't care about prices. Prices are it's the market that takes prices, and whether they're going up or down has nothing to do with it. So we're not watching Bloomberg terminals all day long. But we are looking at the underlying constituents that build our portfolios. And so when there is a fund that's made available in the marketplace, I'll give you an example. In Europe, we run some funds for a French advisor and hopefully some other advisors in the near future. Amundi, it's actually the biggest European fund index provider, because iShares and Vanguard are strictly American. And they have a global property fund. Now, I bet most advisors don't even know that thing exists. It's about as cheap as the iShares fund, and we're going to use that in Europe for these guys. And so that brings us intelligence back to the UK that may be a suitable product for, I don't know, an offshore bond or something else. And it's what we do all day long, is look at what is available in the marketplace and how it might fit into the portfolios. I'm sorry to say that I've met too many advisors over the years that, you know, haven't really looked at their portfolios for sometimes a number of years. And we can tell because they're still using funds that, you know, everybody knows should have been superseded by a Vanguard fund at half the price. And because they've got a lot of other roles to play. So, you know, we I would have to say, when adding to that, you're buying and selling funds on a daily basis, not what we do. Frankly, you should change funds very, very rarely. We're in the buying and hold business, but there are times, maybe once a year, once every couple of years, where there is some changes that should be made sooner rather than later to get the cost of the portfolio down, or move to a fund that's got a better tracking error. These are things that probably most advisors are not going to have the time to be able to pick up on.
Craig, right at the start, I talked about shared beliefs and values, and I cannot think of anything more disingenuous than, without naming names, I know people who will tell people to do things and then go off and do things differently themselves. So I think when we talk about what we do with you is exactly what I would do with my own money. It's what my mother would do with her money. But alongside that, you were mentioning about taking the best academic ideas of the last 50 years, and I think there's a core of people in this country which are still not clear on that really they sort of see investing money as something that a pinstripe stockbroker does, or a very, very sort of fancy fund manager who advertises in the Sunday Times does. Just give us a bit more on this you know, the beliefs and values that we share and how we use this academic evidence.
Yeah, it's not actually, it's more like 60, 70 years now. We've been using 50 for about 10, 15 years, haven't we? I think 1956, was it? Harry Markowitz wrote a paper which really started the whole ball rolling in this space of the research into returns and where do they come from which he actually won a Nobel Prize some, I think, 20, 30 years later. And the big story started with computers in the 70s, because it's pretty hard to analyze things with an abacus if you're trying to look at your returns from thousands of stocks, but computers really opened this up. And I know that, you know, from my experience in the UK, the advisor community in the UK up until the internet really got going at decent speeds, the only information we had was given to us by fund managers and insurance companies. We had no idea what the heck the world was, what the research that was being done. You know, professors don't advertise their wares. They just print their paper. It gets peer reviewed. Other people pull it apart, and the science moves on. And that's it. It gets buried away with 1,000 other papers. Whereas a fund manager who's had a good 3 years by luck or skill will have his performance on every billboard. So there is this problem with the sheer wealth of the financial service industry and the budgets they have to be able to continue publishing material saying we know what we're doing here. And then on the other side of the story, we've got the academics who are not motivated at all by profit to share their work, saying, you know, when we look at this, you guys can't do what you say you can do. We have this conversation all the time with these guys when they cold call us, and we say, you know, based on what evidence are you saying you can do X, Y, and Z? And they don't have any at all. This is a bit like homeopathy. You know, I'm sorry for those listeners that believe in these the products, but there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that it works. And yet chemists and drugstores around the world make a fortune selling these things. And regardless of the fact that it doesn't work, there is still a community of people who keep on buying it. It's just very, very heavily biased towards the financial services community because they have the budget. And it's not helped by those of us who are practitioners in this space. I was talking to you earlier on, Duncan, about WH Ireland. WH Ireland, I'm not picking on them. I just read an email recently. They have nearly 3 billion of assets. We have about 1 billion. They have 36 million of revenue. We have about 1 million. So it goes to show you the difference. I mean, they've got offices in London, not sure they're necessary, and they've got very highly paid fund managers and lots of Bloomberg terminals at 20, 30,000 a year. We don't need them. But nevertheless, it doesn't take much to see that out of £1 million a year, but to only pay some rent rates and other costs around here, there's not a huge budget left for us to go and, you know, do some billboarding. Whereas WH Ireland can quite happily pay 20, 30,000 a year for mailing lists and all kinds of the best looking brochures, etc. It's very heavily biased and skewed towards these guys. And it's only the impartial advisors, like, you know, I'm still technically an advisor, I don't do a lot of it nowadays, but yourself, Duncan, and the other guys you work with, who are paid by the client. It's worth saying that I know you of old, and myself, we were doing this way before RDR came along, where the regulator told us to do it. We just saw it as a better way of doing business, not being conflicted, because our revenue stream was with the client. Go back 10, 15 years before that, and everybody was paid by insurance companies. No wonder we weren't reading any other literature. I mean, it wasn't available, and we couldn't find it without the internet. But, there was an awful lot of conflicts. Those conflicts are still there to some degree. And people, watch Wall Street and believe that these guys can do it. But the evidence is they can't. I mean, there's one thing worth every client should carry in his head when they think about finances. You should start off with the principle, it's a zero-sum game. And it's not difficult to understand this at all. If the market makes 10% over any given period of time, and my fund, and I'm a magic fund manager, shall we say, and my fund makes 12, then somebody must be making 8. The numbers don't add up any other way. The whole market return is divided out amongst the whole of the world, the people in the world who are owning those stocks. The vast majority is held by professional fund managers. And so the winners are only being offset by the losers. So what you're hoping is that your fund manager is one of those winners. And there is absolutely no evidence to say that you can find winning fund managers in advance. Go and find the paper. It just hasn't been written because there's no evidence to say that you can find winning fund managers repeatedly in advance. And when you start with that in mind, it allows you to cut through a lot of the misinformation that is pumped out there. 3 years of... And one of the other interesting things about numbers is that, unfortunately, in fund performance, random and skill look exactly the same. You have really no idea what 3 years means at anything. Did that guy just luck out? Was it a monkey throwing darts at a board, or was he really skilled? And if he was, can he repeat? Again, there's no evidence he can. So you've got the industry working against you, human behavior working against you. I think it's really only us as a poorly publicized group of advisors are actually going to be able to help clients get away from these guys.
So, Craig, we often draw parallels with medicine in the work that you and I do. And when we look across that and contrast that in medicine, we just wouldn't get taken seriously with the sort of, if you like, the lack of supporting evidence for a lot of what goes on in our industry. Does it frighten you, frustrate you, worry you? What's your view on that?
Well, it is frustrating. It seems to be very... governments and legislators, regulators are concerned about public welfare. And so, drugs have to be tested, etc. So people can recognise that bad practices in healthcare, lead to poor outcomes with human health. So we need to do something about that. But I just don't think it's perceived that personal financial welfare goes down the same path. We all universally don't want harm to come to human beings. And we've seen things like when drugs aren't properly tested. So we improve our healthcare. But in finance, there's just not such a filter. I don't think they see fund management as bad. What I think they see is the occasional rogue fund manager or the occasional rogue advisor, and that's what they concentrate on. The actual way in which people manage money, I don't think there's a focus on it. I don't know whether there's an awful lot of lobbying power with the large fund managers. I mean, the tide is changing, but I don't think that's coming from governments or legislators. I think it's coming from us. So. Yeah, it is frustrating, and it's painfully slow. It's very hard to get this message across to clients that traditional methods don't work in the way they think they do. I would suggest that the vast majority of fund management down through the ages is wealth destroying, not wealth creating. If it's not the fund management industry, it's clients themselves. I was talking to somebody in the office today, a junior here, about the traits that people have that you and I have to work against all the time, such as buying high and selling low. Well, rather, what should be happening, which is buying low and selling high. But the truth is, everybody does the opposite. You know, they see a great moving fund or something that's done really well. They want to buy more of it. Well, it's already probably fairly highly priced and they want to buy more. And they don't want to buy the thing that looks like a bit of a dog at the moment. And yet that's relatively cheap. So their behavioral patterns are destroying wealth. So, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done here in this space.
In a similar vein, we often reminisce and look back and say, well, crikey, 15, 20 years ago, we had Betamax, we had VHS, we had video, we had Ultra HD, now we've got 4K. I think you've touched on many of them, but what do you think are the most fundamental things that have changed in our industry that people really should open their eyes and ears to?
I can think of two things that have changed in our industry. I mean, one is costs. Without a shadow of a doubt, that's really been playing into the hands of the end investor. Vanguard now run $3 trillion. That's an enormous amount of money. You and I will both remember the days of old when we used to go to the back pages of Money Management and go down the list and look at funds based on performance. And costs really never entered into the equation. Because everybody charged 1.5% per annum management fees. And there really was no disclosure on all the other costs, which would often take the costs of the fund to 3 or 4% a year. Now, you think about 3 or 4%, and we're buying funds on behalf of clients now at 0.05 of a percent. So if you think in basis points, that's 5 basis points compared to 300 or 400 basis points. There's a tremendous drop in cost those days. You were seeing the cost of platforms coming down, etc. So there's almost undoubtedly that is money in the pockets of the investor, and it's the fund management industry is having to live on a lot less cash than it used to. I think the other thing that's changed really in our profession, if you like, is the change in the way in which advisors are working with clients. When most of us joined the industry, I cringe when I have to talk about our history, but we were salesmen. You went and became an insurance salesman because there really wasn't any. There was no such thing as ISAs and PEPs, and even personal pensions were, if you go back far enough, people sold life insurance products. And that all exploded because of maximum investment plans back in the 70s and 80s, a bit before my time. The salesman went to see somebody and tried to sell them 100, 200, 300 pounds a month and left the building, and the investments were but a box ticked on the application form. And that has morphed over the years thanks to regulation and to, I would say, platform technology has really helped us all, because that has allowed clients to pay us instead of insurance companies. That all happened before regulation changed for most advisors. But the change in the way in which advisors now sit and work with clients and getting the investment right and monitoring the investment, reviewing the investments and changing it as they go through time, because 25-year-old putting £100 a month away really doesn't need to worry too much about risk. If the market falls by 50% tomorrow, he buys another £100 worth. He buys twice as much stock. But if you're 65, 70, and your health's not too good, do you really want to risk £1 million of assets dropping by 50%? There's clearly a need for change, and that change may not even come from the client. It may be, certainly you and I, Duncan, have had to sit with clients saying, really, do you not think that the risk you're now taking is a little bit high given your circumstances? So those are conversations we just never had 20 years ago. And this is all to the advantage of the client. He's spending less money on advisors, on the products, the custody, the fund management, and he's getting far more successful outcomes because he's working with an advisor who's committed to him, because he's being paid by him, not by the insurance company. So I think those are really the biggest landmark changes we've seen in the last 10, 15 years.
And looking forward, and I have to ask this question because there was a great story in the FT this week about the potential impact of artificial intelligence, where they ran a competition at Columbia University between a human lawyer and some artificial intelligent counterparts, during which they both had to read a series of non-disclosure agreements with loopholes in them. And the AI, the artificial intelligence, found 95% of them, and the humans found 88%. But I guess what was what really was more poignant was the humans took 90 minutes, and the AI machines took 22 seconds. If we were to just sort of, if you like, look forward a bit, where do you think the where do you think the major changes might come in the next 10, 15 years?
Well, difficult. You know, obviously you realise that forecasting is not our business. But there's still more fat to be got rid of on costs. Platform technology, clients don't realise it, is super expensive. Holding people's assets in multiple accounts and all the work that has to be done behind the scenes is expensive. So when platforms were young and small, they were costly. But as they gather assets, just like Vanguard, they'll become lower cost. So I think we're going to see some squeeze on costs at platform level. I think there's still fund costs to come down. I mean, in our space, in indexing, the stuff is pretty cheap. So an extra few basis points isn't going to make a great deal of difference. So I think we're pretty much we're through the optimal phase of cost reduction. AI is an interesting concept because you're dealing with something black and white there that you can program. The computer was having to deal with a sheet of paper or a set of characters in a program. It wasn't having to deal with a human being, and we're slippery customers, human beings. The amount of cognitive bias we carry that need controlling. Kahneman's book, was it Thinking Fast, Talking Slow? I can't quite remember the title. He's a very intelligent guy, top of his field. I think he won a Nobel Prize. He says in the book that, even though you've read this book, don't think that somehow or other you're going to be free of these bias. You can't get rid of them. They're hardwired in through millions of years of evolution and nature and nurture. I used the sunken cost fallacy today with two fire extinguishers that are coming up to the end of their life, and I said, just get rid of them. We've already paid for them. We can't get the money back from them. They're gone. But people hoard. They always will do. And I don't see Homo sapiens changing their millions of years of evolution overnight. AI is just not going to change it. We're going to have to sit these people down and say, this stuff doesn't work. And no, that's not the way to solve this problem. And I don't think a computer can do that. I think if you've got a really simple solution, like I want to put £100 away for 20 years, you can do that for a tick box through an app. But trying to work through some trusts, extracting income from portfolios, tax management, da-da-da-da. I kind of think, if I got a large pot of money, I want to sit across the table from somebody who gives a damn about me, who cares, and is going to be sitting at home thinking about that issue that I brought up. And that kind of quality of human interaction, don't think you're ever going to get rid of that. I really don't see max headroom on a screen doing that job. Human beings want to interact with human beings. I don't like cycling alone. I much prefer cycling with somebody else. I don't care if it's behind me all day, and I can't explain why. I just do, and it's just what we are, and I don't see that changing. So changes to the industry in terms of investing and how we build portfolios, and don't forget, we don't build them here for any magic. It's simply by reading the information. I think we're pretty much towards the top of the pyramid in terms of understanding what works and doesn't work, and it's a heck of a lot simpler than the industry would have you believe. Unsuccessful companies tend to give you better returns in the long run than successful companies. Why people overprice successful companies? These metrics, I don't see them changing. I think they're fundamental. So whilst we keep reading the literature, we don't think there's going to be an awful great sea change in the way in which things get invested. Duncan and I, I'm sure, have seen every year or two, it's the latest new thing, absolute returns or some other structured product. This is the industry trying to re-engage you into a new way of buying their product. We will be there to try and stop you doing it. And then they all fall apart, and in a couple of 3 years, it's something else. So I don't see a lot of innovation in actually investing. I think we're pretty much there, to be honest with you.
Most people who know me, Craig, would know I'm a horrendous sports buff. And what a book I read, Moneyball, which was based on Billy Beane, if you like, not really a failed baseball player, but a baseball player didn't quite achieve what he really should have achieved with his talent. And he moved into management and he basically transformed baseball. And the way baseball's been transformed has morphed into English football, into other sports as well. But by saying we're using the wrong metrics to measure people, you know, it's just way too subjective and everything else. And, you know, this has been a brilliant conversation. And you've touched on why we use evidence and we've talked about the things that we use to build portfolios. Do you think, that's my only thought moving forward, that eventually there will be more acceptance that this myth of hedge fund, absolute return fund, smart active management, do you think it's going to get more exposed over the next 10 years and say, look, hold on a minute, we can explain all of this. We're just looking at the wrong way here. We can start explaining some of this. And that again, that parallel with the sort of Moneyball, Billy Beane will become more apparent and what we're doing will become more commonplace?
Well, actually, Moneyball is one of my favourite films. I must have watched it 10, 15 times. My wife regularly comes in and says, you can't be watching that again, can you? And not only is it a good film in its own right, but it just resonates with me as being kind of everything that's wrong with so much of life, really. There's so many areas where you know, things aren't done objectively based upon data and information. And all these biases I've been talking about, you know, that they have far too much sway in the decision-making process. So, yeah, one would hope that the world generally become more rational, although when we look across the ocean at the Americans putting something like Trump in power, you do kind of wonder whether sanity will be restored and how capable we are as a species of moving to a lot more objective world. But, you know, planes don't fly, bridges don't stay standing, phones don't work unless you use science and use the information objectively. And it needs to flow over more and more so into fund management, etc. So there's a large and growing community of advisors that have gone down this road. It's it's a lot better business to be in. I think most of us realized that when we were trying to pick funds, we didn't look at a fund and say, you know, this fund will absolutely make it, and I stake my children's lives in it. We didn't think that way. Just we were guessing. You know, but in our business now, you know, we invest with absolute certainty that we know the characteristics of the portfolios, we know where returns are coming from. It's not going to blow up in our faces. There is no Bernie Madoff in the portfolio. It cannot go, can't go off the rails when there's 20 odd thousand stocks in the portfolio, stocks and securities. It is a growing community, but you know, I come back to the high ground is held by the existing incumbents who have all the budget. I mean, you mentioned hedge funds, they charge 2 and 20, it's 2% a year. We charge 0.1 for our fund management. They're charging, so that's 10 basis points. They're charging 200 basis points and 20% of any profits. Even though the data on hedge funds is absolutely terrible, you know, people still put billions with them. So they've got the budgets. They've got the budgets, they've got the cars, the houses, the lifestyles, and you know, people look at them with great envy and think these guys must be doing something right. There's another famous book. Where are the clients' boats? I think it is. Where are the clients' yachts? You know, it's the fund managers that had the yachts, not the clients. It's just a big transfer of wealth from investors over to these guys. Yes, I hope it changes, and we'll do our part. But we hope that this message does get through. It's appalling. It hasn't. It doesn't. But there aren't many loud voices out there. We don't have the marketing budget of these players.
Craig, this has been a brilliant insight for our clients and I think also for those people contemplating or contrasting what they do and looking at what they do. So I want to thank you for your time and I think it's a really useful resource that people should use and listen to. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on.